You're listening to Sunday Nights with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and Radio Australia.
Thank you for joining us on Sunday Night. Well, after our heated exchange over gay marriage, something a little more lyrical in this hour. In a few moments' time, we're going to meet Phil Smith, principal trumpet with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra for over 20 years, under the batons of such maestros as Zubin Mehta, the great Leonard Bernstein, and many others. Phil will join us to talk about faith, music, and some of those great maestros. Following Phil Smith, of course, some of our regular features. The Midnight Inquisition, get yourselves ready for that. Noel Debien with a postcard around 12:30. And at 1, the chat room. Ian Barnes will be along to take your calls. You may want to pick up the issue of gay marriage, the ACT government capitulating this evening on the issue, saying that it had to fall in line with what the federal government were proposing, that is, non-recognition of gay marriage, but recognition of civil rights for homosexuals. You may want to comment on that, or any of the other issues of the week that are of concern to you. That will be in our 1 o'clock chat room with Ian Barnes. Right now, however, let's have a listen to something of the talent of Phil Smith. Here he is with a little transcription of Fritz Kreisler, arranged by Bernard Snell, Schon Rosmarin. The strains of, well, the music of Fritz Kreisler there, arranged by Bernard Snell and played by Philip Smith. Philip Smith has been principal trumpet with the New York Philharmonic, one of the world's great orchestras, for over 20 years. In that time, he has played under some of the world's greatest maestros and had the opportunity to play some of the greatest works. By way of introduction to Phil, we heard that transcription of the music of Fritz Kreisler. Now let's hear him in the centre of one of the big works. This is Mahler 5, and listen for the trumpet line from the first movement of Mahler 5, Phil Smith.
Thank you. the music of Mahler and the trumpet so busy in the background of that section of Symphony No. 5 is Phil Smith. Phil, principal trumpet with the New York Philharmonic for many years and a member of the Salvation Army. Phil and his wife Sheila are visiting Australia and they're our guests on Sunday night. Phil and Sheila Smith, welcome to Sunday night.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
It's good to be with you.
Phil, when you talk about a symphony orchestra like the New York Philharmonic and you bring Mahler into the equation, you're immediately talking about the tradition of an orchestra that goes back to Mahler himself.
That's right. Yep, he was one of our conductors. And it's kind of impressive to go down into our lounge and look at all of the various conductors that are there and see some of the great names and, you know, this young picture of Mahler himself.
As a young man, you were a member of the Salvation Army band. Did you have aspirations as a kid to sort of one day stand on the stage of a symphony concert hall and play? Or was this a sort of a life by accident?
I wish I could tell you that this was all a plan. It absolutely wasn't. You know, I just liked playing my cornet. And like a lot of young kids, you know, was active in all of the different music programs that the Army had and whatever you could do at school. And then when you get to be in your last few years of high school, and the guidance counselor says, well, what do you want to do? Where are you headed? And you say, oh, I don't know, typical young teenager. And, you know, playing the horn was what I wanted to do, what I loved to do. And so that's kind of where I ended up. I kind of went into music with the thought perhaps being of becoming a music teacher. And someone suggested to my dad that I ought to consider auditioning at Juilliard, and I did, and I got in. And to me, I didn't know what that was about. And then to get into a school where you had to play trumpet and deal with what trumpet players deal with, like repertoire, orchestral repertoire, transposition, I had no clue of what any of that was. And then, lo and behold, you know, you take your first audition and you end up in the Chicago Symphony, and you only took it just to find out what an audition was like, and the rest is history. It's just sort of snowballed. It is truly, in a sense, a bit by accident, other than that I don't believe in accident. I believe that it's been God-led.
There's a big cultural transformation there too, isn't there? I mean, the Salvation Army, particularly growing up, say, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, was very much a world unto itself. To make the transition into that concert arena, it's a different cultural environment completely as well, is it not?
Well, sure, yeah. You're coming from a brass band church feeling, and you're being thrust into the arts. For me, that was pretty interesting, to be thrust into something that was full of competition and ego and, you know, worldliness, if you will. To see what was to be, you know, and as anyone in the arts knows, you're mixed in with lots of different ideas, and to sort of keep a handle on this as to who am I and what is my faith and how does this apply and what's God's will for my life and does God really want me to be a part of this? And you know, it's at the time you don't know. Now looking back, I for sure see that, you know, this was all part of God's plan.
Let's talk about the who am I for a moment. You grew up in a Salvation Army family. In fact, your father was a very noted cornet soloist in his own right, achieved some international attention both inside and outside the Salvation Army.
Yeah, my dad, Derek, was a very fine exponent of the British tradition of cornet playing. He was principal cornet in Her Majesty's Royal Horse Guards, the blues band. And he also was principal cornet and soloist with a famous Salvation Army band just after the war called the Rose Hill Band with Albert Jakeway. And he toured as a young man Canada, and like a lot of young men after the war, the grass was greener on the other side, and off he came. And so really, you know, we as a family sort of were following, you know, his aspirations and his love of cornet playing as it was expressed through the Salvation Army.
Coming through the Salvation Army, and as I said a moment ago, into the wider world of music, what held you inside the faith tradition? I mean, were there mentors that have maintained you through the years, both in the symphonic world and within the world of the Salvation Army, people that you basically said they provide a star to steer by?
Well, I think, you know, the Salvation Army was my expression of Christianity. I think you have to go past that. While, yes, as a youngster, as a young person, I was a Salvationist, what it was about was my faith in Christ. And so mentoring happened on a spiritual level as I grew and started reading God's Word for myself and discovering who God is through Christ and what that meant to me, and listening to Christian speakers on radio, in person, reading books, reading the Bible. That was all part of that. And then in addition, then you've got this, well, perhaps God is leading me in my life to be a musician. This is obviously the gift that God has given me. And this is the venue that he seems to be showing me to go in. And so whenever I would do things, like for instance, the audition in the Chicago Symphony, my approach was to go and play the best that I could play. And in my devotional time, to be saying to the Lord, you know, Lord, if this is what you want me to do, then you're going to have to open the doors. But I'm going to give it my best shot. And so I truly believe that that's the way that God has worked in my life, that I'm sensitive to wanting to be like him, wanting to represent him, and having those spiritual mentors, either through the Army or throughout the entire Christian faith, as well as having musical mentors that were both Christian, but then also in the orchestral world. And, you know, people like Maurice André or Bill Vacchiano or an Adolf Herseth or even my own peers, a Wynton Marsalis or guys like that, where you're just mixing with people who you admire from a musical viewpoint as well.
Those people with the musical viewpoint, though, also, you know, you work with them socially, you mix with them socially. At some point, do you get the feeling, have you got the feeling during your life, gee, this is all too tough, I just got to decide one or the other. You know, I'm trying to live in two worlds and it's all a bit hard.
Well, no, I don't think so, because I think as a Christian, we are told to be a part of the world. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. And so, yeah, I'm in the world. It's my job to be in the world, and it's my job, hopefully, through, well, as somebody said, you know, show Christ, and if you have to, say something. The idea is to live your life as a Christian in this world, and you know, if we talk about in the Bible the fruits of the Spirit, the marks of Christ, those will be evident just in the living of one's life. And that's what God wants. He wants us to be the tax collector or the accountant or the policeman, or he wants those that love him in the world being his, you know, his instruments of flesh, if you will.
Let's talk a little about some of the inspiring characters you've worked with. You mention people like Wynton Marsalis and Maurice André, two of the great trumpet players of the last 50 years, but of course both utterly different in their approach to the instrument. You moved over from cornet playing. That's a different aesthetic again. Who do you look for, and who are your mentors, and who do you admire, I guess? What do you get from them?
There's a lot of mentors. Obviously, I picked out some that were trumpet-oriented, but you get them all through the orchestral experience. I mean, seeing conductors as a young, as a fledgling, as someone who's interested in conducting, and at one point conducting Salvation Army Band, I would love to watch conductors and sort of bounce questions off of them. I remember one time the Salvation Army Band that I was conducting, we were going to play Mozart's Magic Flute. And so I went up to Leinsdorf as we were working with him, and I said, "Mr. Leinsdorf, could you tell me how you start this piece? Do you do it by dictating the rhythm, or do you actually just conduct it through and let the band or the orchestra count the rhythm out?" And so he gave me a little bit of a lesson at that point. So there's all kinds of mentors that happen in there, and you know, that's what's really neat. You find out that some of these legends, I mean, for me to play with Lenny Bernstein, watching Lenny Bernstein as a kid was absolutely thrilling. And then to see someone that I envisioned as being 10 foot tall, and in actuality, he was only a little short 5 foot guy. But to see him on the stage and to work with him and to see the greatness of the gift that was there, but to also see him as the man and what his foibles were and that whole thing.
Well, he's
a
man
kind
who,
of interesting.
Yes, he's a man who does have a reputation both on and off the concert stage. I mean, Bernstein lived larger than life. He's a man who's known for the exoticism of his tastes.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you read you listen to his Mahler set, which I guess is one of the ones he's most famous for, in the sense of it's all the benefits of the Bernstein enthusiasm, because on occasions he's criticised for taking a bit too far, but it also has that great, well, the great gift of the love of the music comes through.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, you couldn't, when Lenny conducted, you couldn't help but play beyond yourself, because what he exuded on the podium, the passion that he exuded, it wasn't just about beating time, it wasn't about being clear, it was passionate. And, you know, when you were going up for some great high C at the end of a Mahler symphony, and he's looking at you, and his eyeballs are bugging out, and he gives you a John McEnroe double-handed on the baton, you know, downbeat, you smack the tar out of that high C, you know? It's exciting. It's exhilarating. It was incredible. And all conductors have, you know, they're all different people. They've got personalities, and they bring different things to it. But playing for him was pretty special.
And you played for him for a long time. I mean, he made the orchestra something of a project for himself. So this was somebody you learned from. But again, it comes to that balance. He's a man who lives a life which is probably utterly different from yours, yet you have respect and indeed even love in some senses for that man and that talent.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would have to say, again, my job was there as a musician to give him what he wanted from the trumpet, and yet at the same time we did have conversation. And while I would love to say to you that I spoke to him of Jesus Christ and that he was saved and I'll see him one day in heaven, I'm not sure about that. but he knew who I was. He knew what I was about, and I make it no secret. If you see a picture of me in my tails, you'll notice on my left lapel there's a cross. And I've had more than one person, when they're having a conversation, notice that their eyes are stuck on the cross and not looking at me in my eyes. And so that's, you know, that cross is on my lapel, one, as a witness, and two, to remind me who I am, that if, when the ego wants to take over, for me to look down and just remember I'm here because I belong to Jesus Christ.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest is Phil Smith, Phil and Sheila Smith. Phil and Sheila are in Australia for a tour with the Salvation Army. Phil is the principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic, has been for many years. Phil, let's hear a little of your work with Leonard Bernstein, Quiet City.
Thank you.
Phil Smith, trumpet, Quiet City, the music. The band is the New York Philharmonic. Phil is principal trumpet with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra in Australia with his wife, Sheila, on a concert tour for the Salvation Army. Sheila, let's bring you into the conversation here. When did you meet Phil?
Oh, my goodness. Seems like we've known each other for a lifetime. We knew each other because both his mother and father and my mother and father were members of the Salvation Army. And my mother and father actually are pastors, officers of the Salvation Army. And so our paths crossed quite a bit, but at one point my mom and dad were stationed in the same area that Phil's mother and father were living. And Phil and I actually went to high school together. And we started dating in the end of our junior year of high school. And here we are.
Went to our senior prom together.
That's right.
this
so
is a mom,
high school sweethearts.
A mom and apple pie romance.
Yes, yeah. It is. And we've been married how long, dear?
Wonderful. A great number of wonderful years.
Many, many years. 33 in June, darling.
Sheila, is there an ego to cope with there? You can't be a brass player, particularly a solo brass player, without having some sort of self-belief.
Well, there's self-belief. I mean, I think in anything that you do, you have to be confident in what you're doing, but there's a line that you don't want to cross. You don't want to be confident that you are the one that's doing it, confident that you can do it. But as Christians, we know that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. So
when a guy's got a nail, as Phil said, a high C and a Bernstein conducting and he's staring at you, you've got to have something inside you that says, I'm going to nail this like you've never heard it before.
That's true. But he's put a lot of hours of practice in it. So
she's heard it.
I heard it. But and he's got me behind there praying.
That's true.
I guess I'm asking if it shows up in other aspects of his life, Sheila.
As far as being overconfident?
A fairly determined character.
Well, I think we all have determination, but I think, again... Well, again, after 30-some years, we've learned how to work these things out. No, I can't say that my husband is pushy or aggressive, confident, and there are times when we all make a stand. You know, we know that this is a place where we don't want to compromise. So if that's being pushy, then he is. But that's a good place.
You've both grown up in the Salvation Army and you maintain your musical links to the Salvation Army. Indeed, Phil, you've been a conductor of a number of Salvation Army bands. Sheila, you're a musician in your own right, a singer.
Yes.
You work in a musical group together.
Yes.
Who shapes the group?
Neither one of us, actually, to be honest with you.
Again, in a group of six people, there's a lot of, input and... I think, well, our pianist is the one who does a lot of the arranging, so she certainly has a lot of direction in what she wants to do with it. Phil has terrific ears as far as where rhythms are not quite right or, you know, something's not quite matching up pitch-wise, so we bow to him when he stops something like that. And then there's myself who'll say, no, I really don't feel comfortable with that, or I want it to go this way. So we all have input. And again, being six Christians together, we put our ego at the door, you know, and want it to be the best that it can be for the Lord, not just, you know, a product for, you know, look at Phil and Sheila Smith, but, you know, look, this is the Lord. This is his music. This is his words. These are his truths that we want people to hear and to... Except
Christian music has a great tradition in the United States because it can build on two strands, both the English choral tradition, if it wishes to, but also on the whole popular music, Tin Pan Alley history, and then gospel music.
Yes.
Just a huge and rich tapestry to draw from. Gospel music, however, requires a deal of sort of freedom and looseness and commitment to almost the music taking you somewhere. It's more heart than head. Is that a contest with the group you have to actually find yourself musically in a place that sort of works and isn't just sort of intellectually correct? It's always a struggle for musicians, that tension, is it not?
Yes, it is. But again, we try to represent so many different styles.
That's part of the problem, isn't it?
It is.
It is, yeah.
We're not, you know, we can't be something we're not. We're not we're not rock and rollers in the, and in we're the not true gospel.
Sense.
Yeah, we're not some of the Christian rock and roll bands. We're not Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. We're not Hillsong out of Sydney. We're you know, we are who we are, and we've got the gifts that we have. Now, what we try to bring to that, I think one of our goals as a Christian group. Music can easily divide a church. You know, there are people who will live or die or stand or fall on the fact that, A, we're not singing the old hymns of John Wesley, or we can't stand these worship songs that just go over and over and over, and we say the same thing over and over. Our point is there's good music all around, whether it's the songs of John Wesley or whether it's the songs of Hillsong or Brooklyn Tab or some of the great worship songs that are out there now. And the good will survive. And what we try to do is tie these together. We may pick a theme, and then in that theme, in the song that we're doing, we'll tie together a hymn with a gospel worship song
and
contemporary one, and blend those together to try to bring people to the point that it's not the music, it's the message. It's and whatever the message, however the message gets out, that's what's important, and it needs to be well done.
Yeah, and I think we sometimes smile because some of those people who would really be upset with contemporary songs often come up and they enjoy the contemporary song that we've presented. Again, I think you have to be sensitive. We don't want it to be so raucous that people are leaving, but we've included the drums, and our percussionist is really very sensitive with what he does. It's not over the edge, but it helps ease those people who might normally not want to have drums in their worship, mm-hmm. say, well, this is okay.
Let's hear an example of that. We Live to Worship You is the album. Deep Down is the song.
Jesus, his praises, his
deep down. From We Live to Worship You, the music of Phil and Sheila Smith, visiting Australia at the moment. Phil, let's talk a little more about your concert repertoire and how you developed that in conjunction with your career as a soloist on the cornet in the Salvation Army. Now, somebody else who does it is Wynton Marsalis. Wynton Marsalis put out a fabulous album a few years ago called Carnival, in which he took out all the old 19th century virtuoso solos for cornet. But there was still evidence in the sound he was producing that behind that cornet playing, there was the directness of a trumpet player. Mm-hmm. You can hear the difference between those two instruments quite distinctly. How do you make the transition from backwards and forwards from one to the other? Because it's not only the fact that there is a slight difference in the instruments, but there's a completely different aesthetic in playing them.
Well, man, you get into a very deep discussion here. I hope you got a long time. But first of all, I grew up playing cornet. And I am now a trumpet player. I don't really consider myself a cornet player. Also, the cornet has moved. What in a brass band sense, the cornet sound and concept has changed from when I was playing. It's gone much more in a very mellow, very big equipment, big mouthpiece.
It's a very fat sound. Yeah.
Very fat, woolly sound. And it to be honest, it doesn't ring to me. I can appreciate it, but that's not who I want to sound like. But to be fair, even if we look at the golden age of cornet, at the time the music that Wynton was playing on those recordings, the American style of cornet playing was very different to the British style, the Jack McIntoshes versus the Herbert Clarks. Very different kind of sound and concept, and obviously Wynton, it flows into that American thing, and I think I probably would flow into that American style at this point too. The English style has gone a very different direction. So again, I can only be who I am. I don't profess, promote myself to be a cornet player. I play the cornet because, quite honestly, some pieces just work better on the cornet versus the trumpet.
And what is it that makes them work better on a cornet?
The cornet has, the cornet can be a little more forgiving. It can sing a little bit better than the trumpet. Just as if you just play both instruments comfortably, the cornet will come out having a little more softer, feminine quality, which is the nature of the instrument, versus the trumpet, which is more masculine, just in its sound concepts and colors. That's what I'm getting at. I'm not trying to. Don't go someplace with that, but it's just a general thing. It's like crocodiles and alligators. They're two different animals, and they have two. While looking similar, they've got different aspects that are enhanced when you play that instrument.
If you had to say a list of the writers who you've got most out of in playing their music, give us an example from both genres. From both the symphonic and the brass.
I mean, that's hard. I mean, I have people say, well, "Who's your favorite composer?" I don't want to sound like I'm passing the buck here, but I have a hard time with that. Some of my favorite composers, i.e., Mahler, are some of the composers. You know, Mahler, while being a favorite because I love the music and the passion that's there, are also some of the most terrifying parts to play. For a brass player in an orchestra, playing Mahler, playing Strauss, playing Stravinsky, is fabulous. But also, when you play some of the symphonies of Brahms, where the trumpet's not all that active, but in the context of the whole, the music is fabulous. And when you hear how he uses the trumpets and the trombones, he's got the horns prominent, but then he brings in the trumpets that can be timpani oriented, but then he matches those in with the trombones, and you get some of the end of the great Brahms symphonies where the brass just is this glorious glow of color. That's different to Mahler. It's different to Stravinsky, but there's still something beautiful there when you do it. The music of Rachmaninoff, if anybody, as far as I'm concerned, people, composers today need to study the orchestration of Rachmaninoff to hear how he writes for brass. He writes in the meat and potatoes sound range of each brass instrument, and when you hear these rich chorales out of Rachmaninoff's music, man, there's no better writing, brass writing, for me than Rachmaninoff.
Similarly, if you go to the world of brass band, you get a divergence. If you get the great music, say, of the mid-century, starting with people like Eric Ball, and then you move to New Zealanders like Tom Rive and Dean Goffin, you get a you get a maturity of sound in the brass, which models itself out of the English symphony sound. You get Elgar, you get Delius, you get Holst coming the brass band. In America, you get a different tradition again through writers such as Curnow and Himes and others, which pick up a different aesthetic, a different sound entirely.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the Elgars and the Delius, you know, those British composers versus Copland or Barber. It's a we're products of our culture and products of our national image and all of that. And again, that comes out even in a brass band field, exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
When do you get your most satisfaction these days?
Good question. I think my most satisfaction is being at home with my family, being at rest. I love, you know, doing a class with kids, a master class, and encouraging kids to play. Sometimes the stress of playing as I've gotten older gets harder. You know, people still come. I've been principal trumpet in the Philharmonic. This is my 30th year. They still come and they want to hear me play it as I did 30 years ago. On this trip, I've been requested to play Blessed Assurance. And people want to hear me hit that high F at the end like I did 20 years ago on the recording. And, you know, that the stress is there. Like, can I keep doing it? I don't know if I can keep doing it. So I think the joy for me now is going and sitting on my porch down in my beach house and just and enjoying my family and going to the beach, not necessarily being under the gun to produce what I know people want to hear.
Phil and Sheila Smith, it's been great of you to give your time to us today.
Thanks, John.
Lovely to have you with us. Sheila, we're going to challenge you, Phil, at least mentally, again. And we'll finish with Blessed Assurance. Now, this brings a number of strands together, of course, doesn't it? Blessed Assurance being one of those old gospel songs that, Sheila, they seem to still resonate, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yeah. I mean, the words have truth in them, don't they? And the blend of the harmonies and the music with those truths just helps us to get a real good picture of who Jesus is and who Jesus is for us.
Yes, and it's blending the British and the American traditions, because the arrangement is an American arrangement, I think.
Yes,
and the song is an old gospel song, and Dudley Bright, a British musician, trombone player, cooperated with you on this little exercise. It's on a CD called Principles. Phil and Sheila Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Let's enjoy Blessed Assurance.
the multi-talented Phil Smith, principal trumpet with the New York Philharmonic and our guest on Sunday night. Well, if that is Phil's party piece and we've had a little of his classical expertise and we began with a transcription from Fritz Kreisler, there is time before the news for another side of Phil Smith's. Something contemporary, an arrangement by Mark Free of Honegger's Intrada. Intrada, the music of Arthur Honegger, played by Phil Smith of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Coming up, Inquisition time, 1300 800 222 1300.